This is episode 15 of The Investors Podcast, and this is our second part interview with Guy Spier.
Broadcasting from Bel Air, Maryland, this is The Investors Podcast. They'll teach you the basics so you can lay your business's foundation. They'll teach you in steps so you'll never get lost. They'll give you actionable investing strategies. Your host, Preston Pysh and Stig Brodersen.
All right. I think, Hari, I think you're up with, and we'll get some investing, hardcore accounting investing questions going here. So, Hari, go ahead and kick this one off.
Sure. So, Guy, the chapter 11 about checklist in the book was very helpful. And thank you so much for generously sharing your checklist. Especially it helps for somebody like me who's just starting out, because it's really, I think checklist comes out of experience, and somebody like me who has less experience doesn't have anything to go on or to start with. One of the lines that caught my attention and I kind of noted down in your book was that you mentioned that we can't use the brain to override the brain. And that was profound to me. And the reason being, I had read this book, Think Fast and Slow, where the author, Daniel Kahneman, I hope I'm pronouncing his name right, talks about the system one and system two and how system one works against us because of the heuristics that it forms and shortcuts it takes. And when I looked at some of the checklist items that you have, like, you know, don't trade during the market hours, or don't sell a stock for at least 2 years after you buy it. If it goes down in value, you're basically applying your principle of, like, you know, countering the system one. And that was very helpful. My question about the checklist was, how do you assess the quality of management in terms of integrity and competence? Are there checklist items that you would share with us, or insights that you would share with us by reading, say, the 10Ks or 10Qs? How would one go about figuring out the competence of a management?
You know, what, before we get into it, what's so interesting for me is that, I mean, I didn't, first of all, the checklist was developed by Monish. He's, and I'm not trying to be falsely modest. He's way smarter than I am, and he's an incredibly, he's got an extraordinary mind in that, you know, if you look at that, you know, those rules of don't sell a stock at least 2 years after you've purchased it, or don't trade during market hours. Hari, I was sitting with Monish in, I don't remember the hotel, it was a hotel in Delhi, and I was asking him how he dealt with, you know, these kinds of difficulties, and he gave me these two rules, and you know, my jaw dropped to the floor. I was like, that is so obviously right. And immediately after that, the next thing I thought was, why the hell didn't you think of that, Guy? I mean, that is not such a difficult thought to have, and that's what's extraordinary, is that his mind sort of finds these things, which the minute he says it, it's like, oh my god, that is just so obvious. So and I would tell you that it's the same with the development of the checklist. And I think, what I find interesting, and this is not, we'll get to the direct question in a second, but, you know, in the Talmud, this is a sort of like book of Jewish lore, a lot of emphasis is placed on crediting ideas to the person from whom you heard them. And I didn't want to usurp anyone's ideas as my own. And what I find fascinating is that I think I take sufficient pains in the book to show the reader that, you know, these ideas are not my ideas. They're primarily coming from Monish Pabrai and some other people much smarter than me. But isn't it amazing how, or I find it amazing that when you truly attribute and give credit to where the idea came from, you know, you guys are interviewing me and you're treating me as if they're my ideas, even though they're actually, I learned them from somebody else. So, that's just an interesting observation to me. In terms of assessing the quality of management, I think that I don't have any simple, obvious answers other then I do think that over time, the more time we spend with materials produced by public companies, the more I think that sometimes it's obvious and sometimes it's just a feeling that we get. And I think that I think of the time when I saw Warren Buffett used to speak to a group of investors collected together by Morgan Stanley. When Alice Schroeder was an analyst at Morgan Stanley, he would appear on either the Thursday or the Friday night and answer Q&A at a Morgan Stanley dinner. And he was talking about Freddie Mac, and he talked about how he'd sold Freddie Mac. And he talked about how he was looking at some of their securitizations, and he noticed some things that didn't make him feel comfortable. He felt like it was time to sell. I think that that's an example of a mind that's extraordinarily well attuned to sort of these minor things that just make you go, well, why would they do that? And if they're doing that, what else are they doing? And I don't think there's any substitute for just time spent reading annual reports. But it's time spent reading annual reports intelligently. So one is, I imagine, I don't know, and that story really stuck with me, or that event really stuck with me. I think it's quite likely that somebody would have said to Warren Buffett, Freddie Mac or Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, the quality of their securitizations is going down. And that thought would have been planted in his head. And then he would have gone and he would have been a little bit more attuned to looking for that, to see if he could see that with his own eyes. So I think that sort of we have to integrate signals that we're getting from all sorts of places. And when we don't know an awful lot, and we know that we're not very knowledgeable, which is a great strength, by the way, Hari, is I think that to go after the world's great investors and to try and see what they saw. So to look at every single investment that Warren Buffett has made, and try and see what he sees. So I would tell you that this is absolutely current. So there's a company called CBI, Chicago Bridge and Iron, and Berkshire Hathaway owns 10% of it. And there's a short seller who's squeezed it. Well, it's not squeezed it. Sorry, he's just shorted it, and he's written a report that's taking the share price down quite substantially. And this is an accusations of by the short seller of bad accounting. Misleading accounting. So this is just a fascinating petri dish, because you've got Warren Buffett owns 10% of it, and you've got a short seller. So you're saying, let's read what the short seller is saying, and now let's try and understand what Warren Buffett saw in the company, because he would certainly not have invested if he didn't feel like the management, 10% of the company, he feels the management is incredibly solid. So what signals is Warren Buffett getting from the company? And what signals is the short seller taking? And then to try and sort of get a triangulation of what we ought to be looking for. And I'll just give you one other example of that is, so I was really impressed, not in a positive way, by how Warren Buffett just sold Tesco recently when these accounting problems came up. And so you get, again, a really incredible example of, this is a guy who's well known not to sell companies just because they're down. So what is it? It seems very likely that something about the accounting revelations made him completely reevaluate the management. And I don't think that it provides any simple answers, but it provides clues, very significant and simple clues as to how this one great mind thinks. And then I just think we need thousands of those examples. We just need to keep building them up and keep learning. But there's no short answers, basically. And I would tell you that that's a shortcoming of so many management books and how-to books, because the nature of writing is that you have to tell the reader two or three big ideas. Otherwise, it's not an interesting read. And what if God is in the details? What if the answers is actually in many thousands of details? It's just not naturally, you can't naturally write a book about it. It would be a very boring book that wouldn't sell. And so much knowledge that ought to be captured is not captured in the literature of business, because it doesn't make interesting reading, I guess. So
the thing I took away from what you said, Guy, is really that it requires a lot of research and a lot of reading. And I mean, you really got to do your homework. You just can't say, oh, yeah, I looked at a couple things and the management's good and then just kind of move out. It it requires a lot of maintenance. It requires a lot of due diligence on the part of the investor to continually look at that.
Thank you, Guy. And you always say that God is in the detail. And thank you for kind of, you know, not oversimplifying it. In fact, I have made mistakes where I read in this book, Give and Take, Adam Grant talks about how giver CEOs would have smaller pictures and the taker CEOs would have like, you know, big pictures in the annual report. And then I started looking at a lot of companies I'm interested, like, you know, I saw HP, like, you know, Mick Whitman has a whole, like, you know, one page picture, whereas even Mitra, like, you know, Jenny from IBM, she also has a big picture. Then I was like, you know, then I thought that's stupidity because I'm kind of, you know, looking at the trees, not the forest. And thank you again, like, you know.
Yeah, but two things that I think that's really interesting. I mean, so so one last idea here is that I think that, you know, I learned that writing a book is a team effort. And I think that any way you look at it, the way I look at it, examining and learning about companies is a team effort. And the question is who we have in our team. So, you know, if our team is a bunch of sell-side analysts, that's really bad. But with all of the greatest respect to Adam Grant, he is an academic. He's not an investor. So it's a cute idea about the size of the photographs, but it probably is not significant. And I'm not sure that I'd want to take my ideas about how to evaluate management from Adam Grant. And so it probably is not a useful, you know, it's more confusing. It's maybe like reading charts. It may be, there may be certain charts that may be helpful, but by and large, you're better off not looking at them. So you know, there's nothing wrong with, I think if you have a really sanitized group of friends, and by sanitized, I mean that they're people who are not grinding an axe in one way or another. And that doesn't just mean that they're not sell-side analysts. That means that they don't, you know, they don't have an ego that they want to prop up. They don't have a need to prove that they're right. There are all sorts of reasons why somebody might not speak honestly and openly about what they saw when they looked at something. But to get, you know, somebody like those engineers at Google, Rishi and Sarah, when you say, hey, what do you think of this? You know, and then ideally those people have an awful lot of experience is a valuable place to take it from. And, you know, I would tell you, learn about management from Adam Grant. Don't necessarily learn about how to read annual reports from Adam Grant.
Okay. All right. Great discussion. Okay. So, Guy, I got to tell you, I thoroughly enjoyed this discussion that you had on owning the Tupperware stock because it led to kind of this deeper discussion of value creation and win-win relationships in society. And this is something that was really big on the Charles Koch book that we read, The Science of Success, where he talks about the same thing of how can I add value to society? And I really found that amazing that you highlighted the same exact discussion and you talk about how you came to that conclusion in your book. Is this something that you can describe just in brief, the story from the book and how that really taught you this fundamental aspect to your now investing philosophy?
I mean, so, you know, it starts off with me reading in one of Charlie Munger's speeches about how the Tupperware parties are a lollapalooza of these psychological effects that make it possible for Tupperware to be so successful. So being the person that I am, I then went and ordered up the Tupperware annual reports. They arrived a few days later. I was orgasmic. Because this was a company with huge margins and a very, very high return on capital. And I just thought, my God, this is an awesome business. I need to buy it. And I raced out to buy the stock. I think I even wrote a letter to Charlie Munger saying, oh, I'm so excited that you talked about it in this speech because here I am and I own Tupperware. I think Charlie Munger would have seen that letter and he would have yawned. And so, God, what a misguided soul. So there I am. I'm all excited. I own Tupperware. I went down to their the investor relations meets down in Orlando a few times. And the guy who runs the company is an incredibly charismatic, very great guy, Rick Goings, who, by the way, responds to every note that I write to him. He writes a note back to me. So I would argue that he's a giver. And, you know, 2 or 3 hours later, every time I'm expecting earnings to grow, but some region in the world is not doing well and sales are just not growing. And I just, you know, it's obvious now, but I just couldn't figure it out. And I can't remember exactly what it was, where it finally dawned on me that you can buy containers that do exactly the same job that Tupperware does in all sorts of places now. And this is pre-internet, so you couldn't buy them over the internet, but even then you could buy them in all sorts of stores for half the price. And it just took me time for the penny to drop to realize that this product was very, very highly priced. And we have a very highly priced product that is very, very hard for you to grow sales, because you can only by creating this lollapalooza of Tupperware parties where you have all these effects combining can you convince people to pay so much money for your Tupperware. But in any normal circumstance, that's not going to happen. At the same time, and this is an example of what doesn't make it into the book, I owned shares in a company called RLI, Replacement Lens Insurance, based in Illinois. I don't remember the town in Illinois. It's not in Chicago, but one of the towns in Illinois. And I was attracted to this company by their extraordinary combined ratio. So they had a very, very, very profitable underwriting operation. And I was so excited to own this because, you know, as Warren Buffett says, the key for an insurance company is to do profitable underwriting. And these guys were profitable. And again, premiums just did not grow. And it took me a long time to realize that the reason why premiums weren't growing is that, you know, everybody knew RLI will offer these excess and surplus lines insurance. But you only went to RLI when you couldn't find the coverage anywhere else, because they would, you know, with the greatest respect to RLI, price gouge you. So you would just, you know, people did business with them when they had to, but they were never going to come back with more unless they were forced to, and that wasn't a good recipe for growth. So that said, you know, it's not like I lost money with Tupperware. It's just that I invested a lot of time and energy. It could have been, you know, I could have invested probably over the same period in Berkshire Hathaway and made a lot more money. So
that's what I say about every pick that I don't pick when it's Berkshire.
It's great. It's a very, very high bar to beat. You know, it's a bar that's available in the stock market every day. So I think that, but then this idea of if you then compare, and I think that moving back and forth, you know, what am I doing? What's Warren Buffett doing? I started to see the pattern that I don't know if it's true to say every single one, but so many of the Berkshire building businesses have this model where they've created something that they can do for lower cost than anybody else. And so it just you become the natural resource or the natural place to go to for it, whether it's reinsurance or whether it's NetJets or whether it's Geico. They're all based on this idea of we're going to drive costs out of our system so that we're the lowest cost operator. And when you can provide something profitably provide something to the market at the lowest cost, you have an extraordinary formula for business, and that's Geico.
You know, this goes to a common theme that we've talked about in some of the other books that we've done. When you see these managers that rack and stack their interests in the right order, and what I, you know, Stig and I obviously argue is the right order is customers first, employees second, shareholders last. When you rack and stack it in that order, and that's where your focus is, it's really difficult for a company to not be successful unless they just got a bad service or a bad product. When they think in things in those terms, and I mean, they need to try to balance it as much as possible. But if they have to actually prioritize what comes first and what comes last, that's how it always has to go in order to have a long-term success of a business. And, you know, just your comments remind me of that, and it's really refreshing to hear.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
The dream of owning a vacation home can be daunting. From finding the best guests to the maintenance to organizing the cleaners after every guest stay. With Vacasa, they make that dream into a reality. As a full-service vacation home management company with vacation homes in key destinations across the U.S., they know how to make owning a vacation home easy and profitable. On top of proactive property maintenance visits by professional local teams, a data-driven booking platform, and around-the-clock support, homeowners earn on average 20% or more revenue from their vacation homes. Vacasa makes vacation home ownership easy. If you're looking to make more from your vacation home by doing less, partner with Vacasa at vacasa.com. That's vacasa.com to get started on your dream of owning a vacation home. Have you ever wondered if there's an AI tool like ChatGPT specifically built for the stock market? A tool that not only aids you in your research and analysis process, but also allows for dynamic discussions? Today, I want to share such a tool with you called Meka. Meka is the AI-powered stock research assistant now enhanced with real-time stock data. Meka does a lot of the heavy lifting of sifting through financial statements and company data and delivers it to you nearly instantaneously, and the best part is that it's 100% free. Try it out today and ask Meka questions like, what is the financial health of Microsoft? How much cash does Copart hold on its balance sheet? What is the return on invested capital of Adobe, or millions of other prompts? Check it out today for free at Meka.com. That's Meyka.com. Today's episode is sponsored by Range Rover Sport. Range Rover Sport leads by example with their dynamic design that rises to the occasion. It's got powerful on-road performance and commanding all-terrain capabilities, coupled with signature Range Rover refinement. The third generation Range Rover Sport is the most desirable, advanced, and dynamically capable one yet, redefining sporting luxury. It's got advanced cabin technologies such as active noise cancellation and cabin air purification, offering next-level comfort and refinement. The purposeful cockpit light driving position sets the tone for a focused interior that promotes exhilarating driver engagement. Award-winning Pivi Pro infotainment is at the heart of the experience and provides intuitive control of the vehicle systems. You can enjoy a dynamic drive and total comfort with optional 22-way adjustable heated and ventilated electric memory front seats with massage function. Design your Range Rover Sport at LandRoverUSA.com. That's LandRoverUSA.com.
All right, back to the show.
Yeah, and that's what, you know, I have a book now about IKEA. And that's what IKEA did. And I think that what's also very interesting about those kinds of business models is that it's very hard to make them successful very quickly and in a short period of time and up front. You have to work at it for many years before they start becoming successful. So again, they're the kinds of businesses that reward people who are willing to build now or willing to invest now for a great future down the road. And so you get certain kinds of people who are capable and willing to defer rewards who populate those kinds of businesses.
And it also really reminds me of the Dando investor. Sorry, Harry, if I don't pronounce it correctly. I've actually been practicing. But Monish Pabrai's book, Dando Investor, where he keeps talking about having this moat. And I actually think he also talks about Geico, because even though everybody can see what another company is doing, like, for instance, Geico or a company like Walmart, it's simply impossible to clone because you don't have that competitive advantage. You cannot, you know, do it as cheaply as they can. And that's really the key to a long-term, a long-term mode.
So now, just to loop this back to a previous thought. So, you know, we as individuals and or people with small businesses have an incredible advantage over people with bigger businesses, at least most businesses, other than some of these companies like Costco or Geico, which is that. So in a certain way, this sort of goodwill strategy is a marketing strategy, but it's a marketing strategy that is predicated on doing something for 5 years before you see any reward. If you go to your management in any kind of business and say, look, I've got this great marketing idea. This is what's going to happen. We're going to have these costs for about 5 years, and then rewards ought to start coming through. You'll be laughed out of the room. The most that a management team is ever going to give you is maybe 18 months. It's like, if you can't show results in 18 months, then, you know, sorry, we can't do this. And that means that there's a skew in the world away from these kind of very, very long-term goodwill creation strategies that the vast majority of people just cannot follow them because they're caught in an environment which just doesn't reward it. And that means that we can follow those, and we have the potential to have a huge advantage over the people who don't see it and over the people caught in corporate environments. And I would argue, I'd like to believe that every single one of these businesses, like Walmart, IKEA, Geico, Costco, the people who started those businesses started with the very same ideas of this goodwill creation. Or if we look at the Rose Blumkin Nebraska Furniture Mart story, she was not concerned about how much money she was making. She was concerned about, as you were saying, Preston, delivering value to the customer. And she never thought about how much, but it took decades, or you know, at least a decade before the benefits of that really started flowing through. So what's amazing about this is that when I understood this, when I understood what Nebraska Furniture Mart was about, there was a part of me that wanted to go out and buy some furniture business in Brooklyn and see if I could recreate Nebraska Furniture Mart in New York City. But of course, that would have required a lifetime of dedication, and it was not my path.
Okay, the next question, and Guy, I really had to apologize because that's actually also about Monish Paprai. So please, as I look down this sheet here with the questions that we sent you beforehand, I can see there's so much evolving about your good friend Monish. So I really hope that we don't offend you by asking so much.
You know what we got to do, Stig? We've got to get Guy to bring Monish onto the show. I think.
Yeah, and then only speak about Guy.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. I like that. We can ask ask Monish questions about Guy.
Yeah, sure.
I have no problem with you asking me questions about Monish Paprai. In fact, I've learned so much from him that you're asking me questions, even though I've written much about him in the book, helps me to reinforce those lessons. So you shouldn't apologize at all.
Okay, Guy, that's nice to know. But one thing that I learned from your book is that Monish sometimes calls you up with an investment idea and says, "Hey, Guy, what do you think about this? Is that something that we should invest in?" First of all, it must be really nice to have someone, one of the best investors in the world, call you up and say, "This is my smartest idea. This is completely insider knowledge. Do you want to invest with me?" That was the first thing I thought. But then the next thing I thought was, so sometimes you must feel that this investment pitch is outside your circle of competence. So even though that you get like the best knowledge from the best investors, from the best investor, sometimes you must reject this investment pitch. But how often do you do that? Or am I completely wrong in my thought or process here?
So I would start off by saying that I don't think that Monish Paprai needs Guy Spier to see if something is a good idea or not. And he's certainly not pitching these ideas to me. It would be more like he's curious, I think, to see how this individual, Guy Spier, with his particular requiring, reacts. So I think that, you know, the way to imagine what is going on is you know, the investment idea is sitting is some kind of reagent, and he wants to see how that investment idea interacts with that quantity that is Guy Spier, and he mixes them together to see what happens. So he's extremely independent-minded. He has, no matter what Guy Spier's reaction is, he may or may not make the investment. I'm just a sort of a jar in his lab, and he's like taking the investment idea and pouring it into that jar and seeing what color it turns. that's what's going on, just to give you a sense. And I think that he understands the way I'm wired and knows that I'm wired so differently to him. So there are things that he doesn't feel very strongly that I feel a lot more strongly. And he's curious to observe how that plays out with me. And I would tell you that, so there are many circumstances in which I have an utterly, I have a violent negative response, but that doesn't stop him from investing. and sometimes I see it and sometimes I don't. I don't think I feel bad about that at all. And I don't feel bad about the fact that I think that he's capable of taking much bigger bets when something is clear to him. And even if something was as clear to me, I'm just not capable of taking as big bets. And I think that I struggled with that for a certain period of time. And I don't struggle with it anymore because, you know, it's about being authentic. And I have to, I'd rather be a true version of myself and have lower returns than have an inauthentic version of myself and have higher returns. So, so he's not pitching, and it really doesn't matter what I think. And yeah, you're absolutely right. In certain cases, I just can't. And there are some cases where it's the other way around. I mean, I think I knew him quite well. I took a trip to Brazil and ended up investing in two for-profit education companies. They did very well. He had no interest for one reason or another. I mean, and I think that, so it's not as if, and I don't think that, it's this idea of pitching is not a good analogy. And this idea of going into an investment together is not a good idea. He's using me as his just a sort of a test tube in a lab to see what color I turn when he pulls the idea in. And he absolutely doesn't need me to make the investments or not to make the investments. He's capable of doing that on his own. But I just give you one last idea on that, is that, so we talk about diversity in the United States. And what we're really looking for is not, when we're looking for diverse teams, it is not, physical diversity. We're looking for cognitive diversity. We're looking for people who think very differently. I think that what we should be looking at for in our investment conversations is, there's some qualities that you want. You want discretion. You want people not to talk about what you're talking to them about. You want intelligence. You want them to be to have low ego, so they're not trying to prove anything to you when they respond. But then I think you're looking for somebody who thinks differently, who just thinks in a different way, who sees the world in a different way, because that contrast provides some value. And then it's sort of like to go away and say, huh, this is the reaction that this person had. Let me try and understand why they had that reaction. And there's a lot of learning in that. So.
All right. Hari, you got the next question. Go ahead.
Sure. So I would like to share with the listeners of this podcast that apart from Guy's book, his letters to the investors of Aquamarine Fund are a fascinating read. I believe there are three letters posted on the website. And one of the ideas I got out of the letter of 2012, I believe, is the idea of Hydra. Hydra is an organism that grows two heads when one of its head is cut off. This is basically where Guy is explaining Nassim Taleb's idea of anti-fragility. It was a great read. My question is related to that. In his owner's manual, Guy, you talk about being a hydra in the investing world, that is being resilient. However, individuals like us who are not really full-time investors are fed or even scared by media and the investment gurus about either Great Depression on the one side of the spectrum or the coming hyperinflation. And we are usually confused as to what should one do. So I wanted to ask you to share your advice with individuals like me about how to manage their personal finance and life to position themselves to be anti-fragile or Hydra, as you put it in your letters.
So, when you figure out the answer, just let me know, because I'm figuring it out as well. But so very genuinely, I mean, I think that there's no easy or short answers, and I am figuring it out. And I don't have, I don't have one bullet that sort of deals with it all. A subject that I don't understand very well, but is so fascinating to me, is how life exists. You know, I was telling my dad this morning of how I saw biochemists at my undergraduate college walking around with biochemistry textbooks, and they'd be studying chemical pathways in the cell. And the way these chemical pathways were presented is if just, it's one loop that exists on its own. And it was a real revelation to me to realize that these chemical pathways, it's really better to think of networks of chemical pathways. And so it's very hard to predict what one chemical pathway will do, because you have, they exist, you know, you can have conclusions which are not obvious. And one example that Michael Crichton talks about in one of his books is this idea of forest fires, which is now well known, where originally forestry services had this idea that if you just put out four forest fires, that was the right thing to do. It turns out that, you know, it's counterintuitive that allowing small forest fires to burn prevents larger forest fires. And now I know that this is related to your question. Yeah, so when you come to the hydro of the investing world, I think that all I can tell you is all sorts of things that I know it's right to do at the margin in order to improve the probability that we will be able to seize upon opportunity when the world falls apart, if and when the world falls apart. So, you know, a few really important themes. Improve the term. For me, it's to improve the terms on which the capital is sent to me. So if the capital can be called away from me within 3 months, I behave very differently to if the capital can be called away from me in 1 year. And that would be very different if the capital is never called away from me, which is what Berkshire Hathaway has. So those are sort of like three different stages. And you could go even further that, you know, the capital that Berkshire Hathaway has to invest, the insurance capital, is completely uncorrelated. What's key about that leverage, some people say, well, Warren Buffett has leverage, it's just called insurance float. But the point is that leverage is not dependent on the capital markets. It's dependent on events in the real world. And so it's completely uncorrelated with the financial market. So, you know, if you take that to individual investors, the absolute key is to not feel like I'm going to need the money anytime soon, to literally be able to just not think about it. And then, you know, and if you want to take that one step further, if there are all these talking heads that are telling you to worry about hyperinflation, you might want to turn those talking heads off. And as a conscious desire to improve your environment, basically. So I think that there are just, you know, dozens, if not hundreds, of these micro decisions that one has to take that gradually improve who we are. And I think that if I come from the perspective of Aquamarine Fund, what I need to do is look for permanent capital. It's not about becoming bigger. It's about improving the terms on which capital is sent to me. And obviously, Monash has gone and done that in a very big way by doing Danto Holdings, which is a permanent capital vehicle. You know, I think that the best place as an individual investor is to work on who's got a call on our capital and why. And then I would tell you, on the hyperinflation side, this is just me speaking, I agree that I fear that, not because I listen to talking heads, but because I see the size of the central bank's balance sheets. And my answer is, every single investment that I make has to be inflation protected. And just to give one example of that, MasterCard and Visa take sort of a percentage slice, minuscule slice, over every transaction that passes through their system, but it's a nominal slice. So as prices go up, their revenues are completely tied or indexed to inflation, if you like. And you could argue that the money center banks are also indexed to inflation. So those are a few of the things. But, you know, as I wrote in the letter, my goal, I haven't fully figured it out. If I'd fully figured it out, I probably would have written that down. One other thing I'll tell you is that all the letters are on the website. So you can go back and you can actually see the progression from not so well written letter to much better written letter as you go through. It's just, you can download them all, basically. Don't laugh at the early ones.
I had a follow-up question for that. When you categorize what is anti-fragile and what is fragile, and you list a concentrated portfolio under fragile, and I was a bit confused because Charlie Munger and Warren Buffett advocate concentrated portfolios, and I wanted to know your thoughts on why you consider it as fragile.
Oh, it's such a painfully... too painfully easy question for me to answer. So when I went into the financial crisis of 2008, pretty much the vast majority of my assets were in 4 stocks. And one of those went down by 95%, and another one was American Express that went down by like 80%. So you know, there's no question that the way I was structured, having a concentrated portfolio in 2008, was fragile. And if it wasn't for some other aspects, dynamics of the sort of system that I was a part of that were anti-fragile, like father and family who stuck with me, and me having some relationships that helped me to focus on the long term, I think that it's possible that I would no longer be running Aquamarine Fund. And so I would still argue that in terms of Nassim Taleb's terminology, I think that a concentrated portfolio is fragile. It's more likely to show extraordinary swings in value. And unless you have other elements of your game in place, that could result in an end to your business. Mm-hmm.
So, Guy, I mean, are you seriously contemplating starting a holding company in the future? I mean, that's from your comments. That's how I took it, to be honest with you.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Support for this podcast and the following message comes from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in over 20 strategic locations. They have extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com. As someone who's constantly on the road and traveling, Briggs & Riley has been a game changer that ensures my travel experience is phenomenal. I'm a satisfied customer of Briggs & Riley myself, and I can certainly tell you that their luggage performs. It's extremely durable, it has amazing features that make packing and getting around easier, and they have the best lifetime guarantee in the industry. If your bag is ever broken or damaged, they'll repair it free of charge, no questions asked, even if your airline damages the bag. They also just released their Simpatico collection of hard-sided luggage. It has this new one-touch feature which allows you to expand your luggage, pack it, then compress it to its original size so a carry-on can still fit in the overhead compartment, plus many other cool features. If you want luggage that was awarded the best carry-on by Forbes, then now's the time to get it. Get your new and improved luggage at Briggs-Riley.com. That's Briggs-Riley.com.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
All right, back to the show.
I mean, I think that it's a logical place to want to go. I think that what I just tell you, though, is that I don't think now is the right time for me. I think I'm probably a little too focused on promoting my book because, you know, it's sort of my baby. And that's sort of where my mind is at right now. I would also argue that the nice way for me to put it is I have a different skill set to Manish Pandey. Just because I'm an okay investor, I've delivered good returns, but I think there's a much broader set of business skills that are required to have a holding company. You have to be able to raise the money in the first place. You have to be able to manage people. You have to be able to pick people. I mean, my hire fire decisions right now are relatively simple because it's a bit like just deciding whether I want to own the stock or not. When you get into close contact with management, it's a whole different set of skills. It's something that I would just tell you, I think that I aspire to it, but I think that I have to be honest with myself and accepting that I may not have the skills to do that well.
All right, guys. So I got the last question here, and I stole this question from Tony Robbins because it was such a good question. If you weren't allowed to leave your children any financial assets when you die, only knowledge, which book outside of your own would you bequeath to them? And can you summarize two or three of the main points of the book?
I mean, I hope that I'm not doing a cop out here, but I'm Western educated and all of those good things. And I have to say that I just think that a foundational text for us in as Westerners is the Bible, and not for, you know, and I'm talking about the Bible as literature, not as a religious text. I just think that, and I didn't have three reasons, but I had two reasons. And the one is that I think that the overall message that the Bible gives is what we as humans do counts on some level. And it's not about whether or not you believe in God or whether you want to be a religious person. But I think that I saw a movie recently, Interstellar. And, you know, ask some really important questions about what it means to be human. And we live in a world where increasingly you can start asking ourselves, with the rise of machines and software heating the world, what is the role for humans in a certain way? And I think that this basic idea, which is fundamental to our humanity, that what we do is important on some level, what we do counts, is something that I would want my children to live with. And, you know, I was looking at all this. So in a certain way, I think that the scientific quest if the only reason why you'd be curious about the natural world is if on some level you came with this perspective that it matters. So for me, that's one lesson that the Bible imparts. Another lesson is that history has meaning. And I think that if you want to live a purposeful life, there are many philosophies that sort of say, well, history doesn't have meaning. It's just one eternal cycle, and you just keep going through it again and again. And I somehow feel like to have children in the world who feel like, well, their individual lives has a meaning, and then the story that we as humanity tell has some meaning that we may not cannot figure out right now, but it has a meaning. It's not pointless for me. Now, that may be overly philosophical for your audience, but or for this conversation, but when you said one book, I can't say The Intelligent Investor. I can't say it's got to be something that hits, you know, our lives in all its profundity. And then what I would just tell you, and again, I hope that this is not a cop-out or it doesn't sound like I'm being highfalutin. I have gotten so much out of just two or three Shakespeare plays that really have touched me to the core. And one I quote at the very beginning of the book, this Hamlet. I think that, you know, that Hamlet is one of the most quoted characters in all of literature in any language in the world. And Hamlet is just this extraordinary figure. And I think that when just by exposing ourselves to a few Shakespeare plays, I think that I got exposed to just what the broad range of human experience. And I think that there's somewhere somebody did a study that showed that if you read literature, a lot of it before a certain age, you become better at understanding what people's motives are in real life because you have just a richer base to draw from. So the number one for me would be the Bible, but not for religious reasons. The Bible is literature. And the second would be, you know, some or all of the works of Shakespeare, if you allowed me a second bite at that apple.
I love the response, and I love the authenticity, Guy, and it's exactly like your book. You know, as people go out and read this book, they're going to see exactly what we're talking about and what we're referring to throughout the interview. So what I want to do real fast at the very end of the show, we always read one of our questions from our audience. So our question this week comes from Michael Valentini, and he writes, "Hello, Preston and Stig. I personally feel buying solid companies run by a competent management will lead to solid returns over the long term. However, I have very difficult time determining what a good price is and determining the value of the business. Do I use a discount cash flow model? Garbage in, garbage out, he says. Do I use relative multiples? Do I use a balance sheet to value the appreciating equity? What makes a stock an obvious value? You know, applying Buffett's rules of buying a wonderful business at a fair price. I understand there's no definite correct answer, but I'm very confused about the whole topic of valuation. Would love any insights that you can afford. So I'm going to give two quick answers, then I'm going to open it up to the floor. So I think the first thing that really kind of reeks out of security analysis is this idea of finding a company that's stable. Whenever you find a business that's stable, you're able to see trend lines. You're going to be able to have a little bit more trust into what the future might hold for the business. So that's the first thing I'd highlight as you look at potentially using a discount cash flow model or anything else, is find something that's stable. That's going to give you a lot better predictability. And the next thing that I'll tell you is that it's not always something that you can stick on a intrinsic value calculator, discount cash flow calculator, or anything like that. And so I've got a story from the shareholders meeting during this past year where a gentleman stood up and asked Warren Buffett. And for anybody who's never been to the shareholders meeting, what happens is Warren Buffett basically answers questions for hours on end. And he gets some really intriguing questions from different people. And there was this gentleman who stood up and he started asking Buffett about his Burlington Northern investment, which encompasses about 20% of the overall Berkshire Hathaway company when you look at the equity. And this gentleman stood up and he started on this really long question. And he started off, he says, you know, Mr. Buffett, whenever I take the net income and I add in the depreciation and I add in the amortization and I add in the non-cash items minus the deferred taxes and the minus the capital expenditures, the discounted future cash flows only yield about a 3% return. And I can't understand why you continue to own this company and make large capital investments in the business. And after the guy asked this, you know, really long question, everyone in the audience, and there was like 30, 40,000 people there at the meeting, everyone just erupted into laughter. And what was amazing was Buffett's response. So Buffett, you know, his immediate response to this gentleman was, you know, I really like this question and you had it going so well right up to the very end there, because we really like to immerse ourselves in that equation that you mentioned, which for anybody who studies Buffett a lot knows that that's his owner's earnings equation. And so what Buffett did is he took the audience, and everybody in there was pretty much laughing at this poor gentleman in this question. And he really truly did have a fantastic question. But Buffett, you know, told the gentleman, hey, it's not always about the numbers. Okay, you can do all those hard math problems, but what we see is something that's a little bit more unnoticed by the general public. And what Buffett and Munger were seeing in this Burlington Northern pick was that the company has the potential to grow and expand throughout the U.S. And this isn't something that you're going to see that's tangible on the balance sheet or the income statement. This is something that the business can just naturally do because of the market size. And so what I'll tell you is it's just not that simple. And I guess that's the answer, is you have to immerse yourself. And it goes back to some of the answers that Guy was providing earlier. You've got to do a lot of research. And if you're investing in individual stock picks opposed to an index, you've got to prepare yourself to do that hard research and truly understand and be able to detect that value that might be going unforeseen by so many other people. And then you have to have the trust and confidence in yourself in order to stand by the pick. So, long answer. I apologize that that was so long, but I want to open it up to the floor to see if anybody else has some other comments.
I would be interested to know Guy's answer to this.
So funny answering in terms of Warren Buffett. If we just talk about Burlington Northern for a second, I think that what I find so extraordinary about those railways is the rights of way. So, you know, I owned for a period of time this gas pipeline business. What was extraordinary about that gas pipeline business is that once you own a right of way, and then there's somebody who needs a gas pipeline built, if you own a gas pipeline that's anywhere in the neighborhood of where the connection, the new gas pipeline needs to go, you have an inordinate advantage, because it's not so much just owning the assets, it's owning the right of way. And creating a right of way, a place to put your pipeline, can be extraordinarily expensive if it goes through any kind of major urban area or anything like that. And I think that when you look at Burlington Northern and you realize that rights of way that were relatively inexpensive to acquire 100 years ago are now surrounded by real estate, and it's just impossible for anyone else to build that. You kind of have an asset that is potentially infinitely valuable because just nobody else can create that. So, how do you can't do that by looking at the counting numbers, as Preston said. It's sort of seeing that and saying, oh my God, this is incredible. And there's only one way it can go is up, as the United States becomes more built out. The value of those rights of way goes up. And I think that those kind of one-way type equations where it only ratchets up, it never ratchets down, is a great thing. But I would tell you that another piece of Warren Buffett's behavior that I just found really telling in terms of this question is when I saw him buy Goldman Sachs during the financial crisis. And so you ask yourself, how was Warren Buffett valuing Goldman Sachs? And at that time, there were so many things going on. There was so much unpredictability. It was hard to be able to predict much about what Goldman Sachs' business would look like, let alone, you know, what cash flows and they were converted into a bank at one point. I don't remember if that was before or after Warren Buffett made the investment. There was talk about them having to get rid of all of their trading division. And so, I think that, so you look at him and what is this in terms of valuation? He's saying, Warren Buffett is saying, we're pretty close to maximum pessimism. All of these things are trading cheaply, including Goldman Sachs. So maximum pessimism, and I'm buying the business with the best reputation and the best brand name. And so there's a certain amount of holding your finger in the air and feeling the wind, I think, in a lot of these things. But I think that over time, what's happened to me is that here's the phrase that I think that I want to be most wary of, or I tell people that I meet to be most wary of. When they hear of an investment idea and then they say, oh, I just need to get comfortable with this. And if you need to get comfortable with it, then it's not cheap enough, Mm-hmm. But I think that there are certain things that just hit you in the face, and they hit you in the face over time. So, I'll just give you one example. So you have all these automobile companies, and in general, automobile companies seem to trade across the cycle between 50% of revenues and 100% of revenues. And I'm not saying that one should value an automobile company in terms of percentage of revenues. But when Fiat comes along and it's trading at less than 10% of its revenues, that's sort of eye-popping. And you sort of then start drilling down and ask what's going on. And I think this idea that it just has to jump at you. And this, it's a bit like finding love. A guy comes to the side of the dance floor and he says, well, I want to find love, but I just don't know how I'll know it when I find it. And the answer is, it doesn't happen on the night where you happen to be wanting to look for it. It happens when you least expect it. And when it does, it'll jump at you in the face. And I think that's true for investment opportunities.
All right. That's some amazing insight. I love the last example there, Guy. That's awesome. So, hey, this is all we have for today. We cannot thank Guy for coming on the show enough. I mean, this was just amazing. We are just so thrilled. We've been really anticipating this interview. So, Guy, your time to give us a 2-hour interview, we cannot thank you enough. And I know our audience is just eating this up. So really appreciate you coming on the show.
Well, I just want you to know that it's such a pleasure to be with you. But it's not just a pleasure. In a certain way, just realize that I wasn't just being generous with my time. I want to be generous with my time with people like you, because I instantly realized when I started talking to you that I was with kindred spirits. And so I learn as much from talking to you as anything that you might think you learn from talking to me. And I would tell you that this very thing where I realized you guys are Berkshire attendees, you love this stuff, you've drunk the Kool-Aid. And so by spending time with you, I get to improve my environment. It's in a certain way quite self-interested. So I was so happy to do it. I'm looking forward to meeting you at Berkshire, looking forward to meeting you at other times. And together, hopefully, we'll become wealthier and make the world a better place at the same time.
Absolutely. You don't get a better win-win than that. So, okay, really appreciate everyone tuning in. We've got the best audience out there. We got the smartest audience out there. So keep your questions coming. We can't thank everybody enough for what you're doing to help promote our brand, our podcast. If you're enjoying this, please leave us a review on iTunes, because that just helps promote it even more. So go out, get Guy's book. It's a fantastic read, The Education of a Value Investor, and we'll see you guys next week.
Thanks for listening to The Investors Podcast. To listen to more shows or access to the tools discussed on the show, be sure to visit www.theinvestorspodcast.com. Submit your questions or request a guest appearance to The Investors Podcast by going to www.asktheinvestors.com. If your question is answered during the show, you will receive a free autographed copy of the Warren Buffett Accounting Book. This podcast is for entertainment purposes only. This material is copyrighted by the TIP Network and must have written approval before commercial application. TIP.